Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unlimited Realities with Lisa Zimmer. I'm your host, Lisa Zimmer, and I am just so thrilled to have our guests today on the show. We have Robert Augustus Masters and his wife, Diane Masters, and we will be discussing transformation through intimacy, one of my absolute favorite topics, and what a profound book. This book is a bedside must-read for everybody who is looking to evolve through personal and intimate relationships. I am just thrilled to bring this wisdom and genius to you today, and without further ado, I'm going to address Robert Augustus Masters, PhD, who is an integral psychotherapist, trainer of psychotherapists, relationship expert, and spiritual teacher. You can find him at www.robertmasters.com. Robert and Diane Masters, thank you so much for being on my show today. How are you?
Really good.
Thank you, Lisa. We're happy to be here. This is a very favorite topic for us.
Oh, it is for me as well. And let me tell you, this book has been such a gift, such a life-changing gift for me personally, but I have turned it on to family members and very close friends, and it is changing people's lives. It's making people really look at themselves with a clearer perspective of really looking at where they have really come up shortchanged in their relationships and really where to put some more effort and energy into certain areas. So I want to start from the beginning, because like I was saying in before we went live, this book actually could be broken down into three different shows. I mean, there is so much in this book. So I'd like to get into first explaining what relational intimacy is as both a sanctuary and a crucible, which is the beginning of your book as we start. So who would like to start with that?
I'll start.
Okay.
Okay. So relational intimacy is not the same as relational fusion. I want to make that clear initially. Relational fusion or romantic fusion means when two people collapse their boundaries, they merge, they feel like they're at one. There's usually a lot of sexual chemistry. There's a sense of being able to tell the other person everything. But it's an illusion. The two people have dissolved their integrity, they've lost their boundaries, and they are in a kind of romantic bubble, which inevitably is pricked by reality within a few months. And at that point, they start to wonder, well, how come I don't feel so good with this person? What happened? And the truth is, whatever they are not liking about that other person was present there from the beginning, but they couldn't see it. By contrast, relational intimacy, real relational intimacy, means expanding our boundaries to include the other, so we preserve our personal autonomy even as we bring the other person into the circle of our being. And that creates a sense of sanctuary, of being
right
in kind of a sacred container wherein whatever arises can be worked with, given that both partners have a mutual investment in working through whatever arises, no matter how difficult or dark it is. When the more unpleasant stuff arises, we could look at the relationship as a crucible, a place where there's inevitable heat, there's friction, there's difficulty. But if both partners are relatively awakened, are truly committed to each other and to their personal growth, they will use such difficult times to further their personal growth and to deepen the relationship. So I often refer to a true relationship as both a crucible and a sanctuary for healing and awakening.
And that way, when you do have the difficulties come up, it doesn't bring the relationship into question. It's almost a given that there are going to be these things that come up as we evolve and as we become more and more intimate with what our inner workings are, what our conditioning is, what our partner's conditioning is, and how that shows up in the relationship. And even though it's at times unpleasant to have to deal with those things, there's also when we do stick with that in that context, we go deeper.
Oh.
And that's very exciting to realize you can go deeper.
That's right, because you know we look at so many aspects within relationship, and you know, in a world of fast everything, there's such
yes
a propensity to throw in the towel. And, you know, are we really trading up? No, we're really just kind of, you know, stepping aside of what the issues that lie within ourselves are. So, you know, this was, I love how this dynamic is going, let me tell you, between the two of you. You guys are like an incredible duo, let me say. I love this.
So we, you know, we work together and do all of our sessions and all of our groups together as a team, so we have this flow that just kind of happens, and it's really great.
Oh, I am just goosebumping with this. So this is wonderful. I love this dynamic.
It's so lovely to be able to teach what we are living. Such
yes.
a gift.
Yes.
And I want
and
you to say something. Yeah.
Sure.
Exactly. There's something you said earlier I wanted to respond to. It has to do with people not having their relationships work and repeating the same mistake over and over.
Yes.
In that case, we could say somewhat simplistically that they didn't pick their partners, their conditioning did. And in other words, what lies unresolved in the person, whatever we could call their shadow side, all the old wounds, the unrequited needs, et cetera, that makes the pick. And,
okay.
And it's inevitably automatic. The same emotionally unavailable partner, for example, is picked again and again and again. Until we wake up to our conditioning and do our work in ourselves deeply and authentically, we will keep making the same mistakes.
And then when we are in a similar situation like that, it is not always a relationship that we can make work. So we have to make sure that we are doing our own individual healing work through therapy where we know what our conditioning is, which means what are the things that cause us to have charges with particular situations? What are the things in our growing up years so that we are constantly drawn to something? Just a simple example, we may have had a father, a woman may have had a father who was very emotionally unavailable. And that little girl inside the woman still is drawn to that kind of man because maybe this time she can get him to be fully there for her. Maybe this time he will fully love her. But we don't know that. And we meet this guy, and he's like that, and he's cute, and there's sexual chemistry, and we think, oh, I'm in love with this man. And we
right.
hang in there in a situation that is not going to resolve unless both people realize that they have chosen out of their conditioning, and as they do inner work and they heal themselves, then they can work deeper on the relationship, and sometimes the relationship then can work.
And at such times, we could often say that we are having a relationship with the other person's potential
yes.
rather than revenge. Then we get seduced by hope, and hope is, I call hope nostalgia for the future. We're always romancing tomorrow. Maybe if I
right.
stick around a little longer, he or she will finally get it, will finally love me, will finally meet me. And that hope can keep us hooked into a relationship far, far past the time when it's over.
Well, it can hold us hostage.
Right,
yeah.
right. And it's stuck. And it's one of those things I really believe when you start to look at what is the trigger within the relationships, that's the kind of the key to really the awakening, would you say? That you
yes,
can address.
Yes, exactly.
And
exactly.
So,
and to be open to the triggers, to not go, oh, no, I don't want this to happen. I just want us to be happy all the time and always mellow and always positive and say, you know what, that's not going to happen in a real relationship. There's
right.
dark and there's light. There's high and low, and it's all grist for the mill of awakening. It all can be worked with.
Yes.
So when we
and
get
it,
reactive with a partner, we're triggered massively. It's unpleasant, sometimes very unpleasant, but it's an opportunity to face our conditioning, to in a sense be grateful for the fact this is now in our face and we have to deal with it.
Right, right. And it helps when you have a partner who understands the dynamics of both communication triggers and really the evolution that you can get through this, because it's
yes.
you know, it's difficult when one person is on the understanding of the work that you do and the other one is kind of completely green and you have to kind of bring them up to par,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Now, can we talk a little bit about what the four stages of intimate relationship and what they are?
Okay. Those stages are an orienting map. We don't actually, when we're working with couples, label them as being in a certain stage, because in most of us, all the stages are present as states. That means temporary arisings. But the first one we call me-centered mm-hmm. relationship. And that means both people are stuck in an egoic place.
What's
and they're,
in it for me?
Yeah, their credo is what's in it for me? And mm-hmm. there's very little awareness. There's a lot of reactivity, a lot of blame, a lot of shaming. It's quite unconscious, and it's quite painful. And but the pain, the suffering that is implicit in such a relationship is what finally will often drive a couple to do some work on themselves or to separate. But that pain does not go away just because we can try and treat it with becoming more sexual, using certain medications, having one partner be more submissive. It's a relationship arrangement that does not work. But even the most mature couple have times of being me-centered, somewhat narcissistic. A mature couple, when that state arises, it's usually recognized as such quite quickly, looked at with compassion, and worked with. The next stage...
Hold on just one second,
yeah,
babe.
Sure.
So in an immature couple, though, that is stuck in the me-centered, very often they'll stay that way for their life, and basically the hallmark of that is lack of empathy.
Okay.
So they're really not in much of a deep relationship, but they can have moments where it appears to be strong.
Okay, great. Okay.
Okay, go ahead, babe.
Okay, the next stage we call we-centered codependent. This is the classic codependent relationship where both people's neuroses kind of lock up with each other. And if we could say me-centered coupledom is two cults of one, I call ego a cult of one, two cults of one having a relationship, we could say the codependent couple becomes a cult of two. They're in kind of a bubble that only holds them, so they're not that open to outside feedback. And within the relationship, very little is done to rock the boat. Both people are really concerned with keeping the relationship intact. So there's a lot of repression, pushing away of shadow material. So,
not
for example,
much challenge.
So for example, if say the man has a pornographic habit, has a promiscuous intention internally, he will not act that out. He will sweep it under the carpet and be good so he can stay in the relationship. So there's a kind of a deadening of passion, of connection, so that the couple can stay together.
Okay.
And sometimes they're excessively nice.
Ah.
Where there's not much challenge or they don't like conflict, so they'll do anything to avoid it.
There's the pathologizing of confrontation. So the couple does not rock the boat. When things get stagnant or dead, they may not like it, but they put up with it, almost like this is how a relationship has to be. It has to be kind of mediocre, a little flat, deadening, very little sexual chemistry. There's a sense of going to sleep, but there's a certain comfort in that, a certain reassuring security in that they know they're with each other.
And they are thinking more about the partner than in a me-centered.
They're more considerate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Huh,
and
okay.
The next stage is a very interesting one. It's has kind of a long title, We-Centered, Co-Independent. So in this case, both people are asserting their autonomy more. There's more of a healthy separation between them. The trouble is this gets overdone. There's too much of a focus on autonomy. You do your thing, I do my thing, we cohabit, we're quite tolerant of each other. There's not much more passion than the previous stage, but there's more integrity. And there's also more of a glimmering, an intuiting of the next stage, which is being-centered relationship, where both people are really in that conscious crucible/sanctuary we mentioned 10 minutes ago. They are living that, and they are centered in that. And for them, their connection is absolute priority, and they do whatever it takes to keep that connection alive and well. There's more polarity between them. There's more vitality, and there's also far more compassion for the what's immature or reactive or not fully illuminated in them.
Yes, and
okay.
We have more of a transparent connection, whereas in the other stage we're talking about the connection is and the dependency, there's more a clinging kind of connection, whereas in this, The connection arises from being vulnerable and sharing the deeper emotions, sharing what's really going on, the doubts, the fears, all the shadow. And the couples at that point have what really makes a difference is when they know their partner's conditioning. They know their partner's deeply, all the details, the things that affected them, of what is showing up now as their default is actually from something from their childhood, so that when they're having a conflict, they can suddenly, in the midst of reactivity, realize, oh my God, my partner right now is looking like an adult man here, but here's that hurt little boy just on it automatically showing up as the, under the stress, and then the compassion kicks in, and you deal with it in a very different way.
Ah, that is so well put. I'm sure all of us can relate to many stages of that we've played roles in throughout our lifetime.
Yes.
That, you know, okay, we were here and now we're here. And
yes.
that's really well put. How can we differentiate between what an awakened monogamy is versus an immature monogamy?
Well, initially we could say that immature monogamy entraps us, especially as a man. We feel trapped by it, hence all the jokes about a man losing his independence, his sexual energy when he enters into a marriage. Immature monogamy is a trap, and it's epitomized by the codependent stage, where we don't feel that great, but at least we have a certain security. It's like being in a job we don't like, but we know we get good benefits and we can retire early. We're kind of selling out to be in it. Whereas mature monogamy, what we're now calling awakened monogamy, is liberating, because in that container for two, there's immense opportunity to work on whatever is unresolved in us, and there's nothing like a truly intimate relationship to bring everything up to the surface.
Amen.
As compared to, say, if we're just doing solitary spiritual practice, we may never touch certain aspects of our being, whereas in a relationship, we cannot hide what's unhealed in us. It's there. And in the highest stage of this, here's the image. It's as if we're both casting a mutually compassionate eye being cast upon the neuroses of both. So the neuroses of both are not seen as a problem. They're seen as here's some stuff that's not quite compost. But with enough compassion, and sometimes it has to be fierce compassion. This does not mean we don't get angry and share some heatedness in a healthy way. There's
right.
a healing.
Okay. So basically we're looking at each other, understanding that, hey, nobody's perfect. They have their stuff. I have my stuff. I have an unconditional love for them. My compassion is open. I'm looking at them through compassionate eyes, and I'm not looking at this as taking away from the fabric of the relationship. I'm looking at this to evolve through for the four.
Yes, and this is true, but you know what's funny, at least the shadow side of that, of the unconditional love and everybody is imperfect, is that sometimes we don't want to hold the other person accountable, that we let them off the hook too easily, and we get so compassionate that we don't challenge. So that if we, you know, we can coast along and then think that we're being very loving and compassionate and unconditional, but sometimes the behavior is such that you need to step in with a fierce compassion.
Right.
That's something I had to learn how to do. I was more the harmony junkie, you know, back
right.
in the
Me too. Right. That was my issue too. I had to learn that I had to get really clear on communication and how to communicate my needs and feelings and to address these things. You know, because these are life changing, and it's sometimes I found that the other person isn't even realizing that they're pushing those triggers or those buttons or those things until the mirror is right there in front of them.
Mm-hmm. That's true. A lot of times our reactivity is so automatic, we just don't know it, and that's part of being in a relationship where you get to
see
it.
See, many of us confuse unconditional love with unconditional acceptance.
Yes.
When
yes.
we truly love another, we don't automatically accept everything they do. And then we start to shift from the ideal of unconditional love to what I would call unconditioned love that is free of our conditioning, which is Yes, yeah, there's a difference there.
Yeah,
people,
I like
what
that.
What people are working toward is to not get rid of their conditioning, because that's impossible, but to relate to it in a way where it does not have a negative impact on the relationship.
Right. Where it doesn't run it.
And implicit in this is that both partners have to have an intimate link to their own anger, because without anger, we cannot protect our boundaries properly. We'll let things slide. We'll become overly tolerant to the other person's behavior. We'll make excuses for them. They're doing the best they can, et cetera, et cetera. We will not challenge them, because in a really working, genuinely intimate relationship, there is challenge.
Yes.
Mutual challenge.
Yes.
And that sometimes has to be backed up with anger. And the key here is to know how to express anger cleanly rather than
yes.
to not express it at all.
And not to let it mutate into aggression or hostility, sarcasm. And when a couple starts expressing contempt with the rolling
right.
of the eyes, then you're in a really difficult stage. That's
right.
very difficult to work with.
Right, and that's, you know, it's a lot of times people will, you know, there's the anger within relationship, and then there's the repression of the anger within relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so in getting closer to understanding anger within relationship, you know, it's a very delicate balance so that it doesn't derail the entire relationship, so that you can look at it as coming to a compromise rather than one being right and one being wrong. And looking at it from that perspective, which brings me to my next question for you. How can we look at jealousy within a relationship as a learning tool to evolve through?
Well, first of all, it's important not to make jealousy wrong. Now, some
okay.
jealousy is really neurotic. We are, for example, jealous of our partner giving attention to others when they're doing so is completely clean. There's nothing underhanded about it. And if we're jealous then, we know it's a massive trigger to do with our history. But there's a lot of times, too, where the jealousy is warranted, where our partner is crossing the line and may be acting like they're not. They may act as if their flirtation with someone else is innocent. They're just playing around.
Just
don't get
fun.
Worried. Mm-hmm. Don't be so possessive. When in fact they are crossing a subtle energetic line, they're leaking some sexual energy, for example,
sloppy.
And we feel a pang of jealousy. Now, our job is not to let our jealousy become this overly dramatic, green-eyed monster. It's more to just feel the woundedness in it, the sheer hurt, and to be transparent enough to share the hurt without shaming ourselves for being jealous and not allowing our partner to shame us for the fact that we are feeling jealous, we're feeling really insecure.
Okay.
In a healthy relationship, jealousy is not looked upon as negative. In fact, in a healthy relationship, no emotion is looked upon as negative. There are negative things we do with emotions, but emotions themselves are not seen as positive or negative.
But I would add that in a healthy relationship, when there is jealousy, generally, that is, in a healthy relationship, there are good, clear boundaries and awareness of that. So if there is jealousy, it would be more that one would say, wow, I realized I felt this real pang of jealousy, even though there wasn't anything that was actually emanating from you in that contact that I saw you have. And what's that about? I feel the stitch in my solar plexus. I can feel an 11-year-old girl there that just got compared to other people that were developing faster. There's, you know, you can
right.
use it as a rich resource to mine what is still left there that's unhealed. Whereas the other situation that we see happen a lot, and I will say it does tend to be more with the man's boundaries, but it's not, I won't make a general statement that that's always the case because it's not, but
okay.
many times women will say, well, I really have a problem with how much my husband is just staring at other women, or I can tell his energy is lusting after different women, or he wants to use porn and I don't, or he, you know, he'll just say lighten up and he'll flirt with people and he'll say it's just for fun, and he tells me I'm insecure. He tells me that I am, you know, making too much of something, and many times we'll find, no, his boundaries are really bad. He's actually being very unaware of where he's leaking his energy, and there was a subtle betrayal that is happening, and the woman intuitively is picking it up.
Right, right. Now, how do we recognize what boundaries need to be implemented within a relationship? As, you know, there's certain people that may not have the same needs of boundaries as other couples or other relationships. How can we look at ourselves and within relationship to address needed boundaries that need to be implemented?
Well, everybody needs boundaries, healthy boundaries.
Right.
So it's a matter of, let's take one example, that which is really tender and vulnerable in us, we could call it the child in us.
Okay.
Needs not only to be embraced, but also protected. Just like if you're a really good parent, you love your child, you embrace your child, you also are completely there to protect your child, no matter what it takes. There's
right.
a sense of protecting what is sacred in us and not letting it be trashed because someone else wants to cross our boundaries and has a good rationale for doing so. So in a healthy relationship, the boundaries are present, they're clear, there's a clear sense of deal breakers in the relationship, and there's also a capacity to let the boundaries expand, to become more permeable, but it's
mm-hmm.
conscious. So
right.
rather than being under boundary, like some people are, and thinking this means I'm really open or I'm very spiritual, or being over boundary, where people get really rigid and tense and tight and guarded, there's something in between. There's a fluidity, there's a flexibility, a permeability, which means we are conscious of our boundaries, and they're like living, psychological membranes in us in a way, and we are in charge of it. So it's not automatically held tightly or automatically dissolved.
Well, here's
okay.
the thing, though, Lisa. If a person is saying, I have no need of, boundaries, or my boundaries are very, very wide, and whatever terminology they give it, one thing that we look at that happens quite often is that when a person is a child, if their boundaries get really trashed, if they get their boundaries are crossed over by an abusive parent or by sexual abuse or some other things that happen, particularly if it's repetitive, then they don't have a sense of personal boundary. Those are gone. That has to be reestablished and worked with and healed so that the person gets access to their voice, to their power, to their no. They have you can't have a real yes unless you have an authentic no. And so that works on, you know, that means that person, if they haven't done any work on that healing, they're going to go in with no sense of boundary and no need for boundary because they don't even know what it feels like.
Here's another angle on this, is that many people will say yes to doing something when they don't really feel yes. They're afraid
okay.
to say no. They don't want to upset the other person. So we would have take them what I would call the myth of consenting adults, where one person or both are saying yes without it coming from an adult awakened place themselves. Instead, it tends to come from a childlike, wounded place that does not want to rock the boat, does not want to upset an already enraged parent or, aggravate a difficult situation.
Okay. So actually, our boundaries can expand as we evolve. And,
exactly.
And oftentimes, sometimes boundaries can even be shifted or changed because there's such a respect and within the relationship that that's not even crossed anymore. So it's a boundary that's recognized but not necessarily always used because it's a non-issue or it evolves into a non-issue.
Yeah.
Can that happen?
For example, you might have a boundary, for example, with a partner where you do not want sarcasm. If your partner's angry, you want it direct, you want it straight, you want it clean, no sarcasm. So if they start to get sarcastic, you can make it clear immediately if they've crossed the line and they're on the hot seat because they know better and they've done it. And their job then is to be honest enough to admit they've done this and to shift gears into the vulnerability that's implicit in healthy anger. But if you didn't have that line there in the first place, they might go ahead, you feel really hurt inside, but you don't challenge it.
Right.
So we have
okay.
to have that. We have to have the capacity to say no and be able to voice it in a way where it really comes across as a clear, embodied no.
Right. That this is the line you crossed, and this is where I'm at with it.
Exactly.
Right. And another thing that we often say is that anger is the guardian of our boundaries. And if we, and I'm talking about clean anger, not aggression.
Right.
And if we had some a history where anger was not allowed or anger was dangerous to express, then we don't, we, our no disappears.
Right.
And so
right.
And getting in touch with that healthy anger is one of the steps of reclaiming our boundaries.
And, I, you know, this is something that I learned in my throughout my adulthood, because I had parents who were married 50 years and lived in a very repressed state, passive aggressiveness, of really showing any true intimacy or anger. So I never saw them mm-hmm. fight. And so my siblings and myself grew up as, you know, afraid of confrontation and avoiding confrontation, mm-hmm. and so not really looking at anger as healthy and not really looking at it as a very usable tool to evolve through or to address in a way that there's any progress with it.
Yes.
So it was
yeah.
A,
yeah.
It was a discovery for me. And you know, there's a lot of that that comes with that I find in the baby boomer in my age group, where we have parents who were generational in their repression, and
yeah.
And a lot of times that kind of seems to manifest indirectly or unknowingly on a shame level. Can we talk a little bit about how we work with shame and our guilt and all those anger and icky stuff?
Well, I mean, shame is probably the most hidden emotion in psychotherapy, spiritual practice, in part because when we feel shame, we so quickly, automatically usually, so quickly let it mutate into other states like aggression, withdrawal, dissociation, because it feels so unpleasant. And,
right.
And yet, to leave shame unaddressed is a major problem. And shame left unaddressed will ruin any relationship. Because if it's not addressed, then it gets used as a controlling tactic. It's kind of operating from behind the scenes. So part of the working with shame is to acknowledge shame when it arises and to know our history with it, to know what was our default when we felt shamed as a child. Did we withdraw? Did we get angry? Did we develop a hyper-intense inner critic? What did we do? So that when it kicks in now, we can say, ah, here's shame.
Right.
And when we let shame, we see shame for what it is, we will feel an automatic activating of our conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And if the shame is toxic, we will feel ourselves really shrinking fast and losing all our power. So it's really important to look at our shame and to know the difference between healthy and unhealthy shame, and to start using shame wisely in the relationship. You know, if someone is repressing their anger and sees it as a bad thing, when anger rises in their partner, they may inadvertently shame their partner for
yeah.
being angry. How dare you be angry? What's wrong with you is the implication. And that person then is re-triggered, because now they're being put down for maybe even a healthy delivery of anger because the other person is not at ease with it.
Right,
so
right.
So in other words, we can shame our partner so easily. So we... One of the key practices for us is to never, ever shame each other. And if it does start to happen, to address it immediately.
And when we're
okay.
working with couples, too, that's something that many times people don't realize, that they are inadvertently shaming their partner. And
yes.
they're shutting down or withdrawing. But so many times it can be just something as simple as saying, be a man, show up. You know, you know, there's just so many different things that people say, and then we'll say, well, that, or the tone. It can
right.
be some words that could be neutral words, but the tone has some
right.
shaming. And, you know, there is healthy shame. That's the kind of thing that happens when you realize that you did mess up, you did hurt someone else's feeling, and it spurs you into taking an action to clean it up. But the toxic shame is more of you almost get paralyzed and you shrink. And that's if you've been shamed as a child and someone else in your partner ends up saying similar things to what was said to you when you were a child, there's an automatic reaction to that they have no clue about, unless they know
right.
their history and they realize, you know, again, it's people becoming, waking up to and being very present in what they're saying and why they are.
So let's circle back to the beginning. I think it's an important point to make here, which is what's really essential here is to become intimate with all that we are, not just intimate with our partner, but intimate with our anger, our shame.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm intimate with my shame, it means I know it very well. I know its history. I know its triggers. I know its signs. I know what my defaults are for dealing with it. I know it really well.
Right.
And I make sure, and my partner does too.
Mm-hmm. Now, can shame contribute to power plays that exist within relationships?
Yes.
Sometimes? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
If I'm shaming you and you're letting me get away with it, I have power over you because my basic message to you is that you're defective, you're messed up.
Right.
And once you, if you accept that, it's like listening to our inner critic uncritically. Once we accept that type of put down, we're diminished. We've lost power. When we've let our boundaries be crossed. Whereas if I'm shaming you and I'm not being clean, your job is to step in and stop me immediately, make a fuss about it. Or if I'm shaming myself by letting my inner critic run roughshod over me, my job is to stop being a passive child in the face of that ugly parental authority. My job is to see it for what it is, name it, and relate to it. And that's
okay.
One of the key things here is to relate to the inner critic, relate to our shame, so we have a little bit of space from it. Because in real intimacy, we're very close to the other or to a certain state, but we're also a little separate from it, just separate enough to keep it in focus.
Right.
Healthy intimacy is like a dance of separation and connection. We're really connected. We're so close, but we also have enough distance to witness what's going on to relate to it.
Mm-hmm. Now,
this applies to. Go ahead.
Oh no! Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Yeah, I was going to say this applies to relationships between people. Also applies to the different qualities that constitute us, how we deal with them. And if we relate to them, we have a little bit of separation. So if your inner critic is very strong, very harsh, perfectionist, all of that, when you relate to it, it loses some of its power. You take back some of the power you've projected onto it, and you start to grow up
in the face
of it.
What he means when he says if you relate to your inner critic is that generally people identify with the inner critic's voice. So when you're hearing yourself say in your mind saying, oh, my God, I am so stupid, I am such a loser, I will never get this right, I always do this wrong, that if you are identifying with it, you are believing that is your conscience, that's your higher self telling yourself that. Whereas if you relate to it and say, oh, that's that same old toxic tape. It comes back every time. It's predictable. It's always to take me down, and it's a voice from my past. It might even be the voice of a toxic parent or a teacher that we had, and that is not the truth.
Right. Okay.
And so we have to separate out from it.
So does shame, is it derived from conditioning from like our models, our parents, our teachers? Does it come from those who kind of were in authority or in parental guidance over us? Is that where shame tends to come from mostly?
Mostly, because there's certain standards and values in any culture, in any family, and when we don't align ourselves with that, there's usually some shaming, whether it's healthy or unhealthy.
Right.
And it's a basic emotion. I mean, you can see shame in a very young child. You can see shame in a dog. I mean, it's an
right.
innate emotion. And its basic purpose is to interrupt what we're doing when we're going in a direction that may not be that good for us. Or we know we've crossed the line. That's healthy shame. We know we've done that. Our conscience is activated, and we make amends. But unfortunately, shame is usually handled so badly that becomes toxic or it mutates into guilt. When
right.
we feel guilty, we're really stuck. Because at least in shame, there's a sense of being exposed, we're vulnerable, we feel awful. In guilt, we're so busy beating ourselves up for what we've done that we just keep doing the same thing over and over and over. I often
right.
say that guilt is frozen shame.
Ah. Okay, so in addressing the shame and being able to name it, we're better apt to recognize it when it shows up. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so then we can then diffuse the shame by altering our thought processing in regard to it. Is that right?
In part. It's more than thought. It's a feeling-based state where we actually feel what we've done. We feel remorse. And when we don't run away from that feeling, and that's just so crucial, when we don't run away from it, then we can say, I'm sorry, from our heart. We can make amends. Whereas in guilt, we wouldn't do that. We would just simply beat ourselves up even harder, almost as if to justify doing the so-called bad deed again. Whereas in healthy shame, there's a movement towards healing whatever has gone on. Our conscience is kicked in full blast, and we know we need to say I'm sorry to the other person, for example. And we may repress that urge, but it's still there. We know.
But I think if we have shame really running our lives, as some people do, because it was so, the toxic shame was so heavy in their upbringing, it's not something they can just say, well, here's shame, or they can learn to identify it and to certainly have more of a distance from it so they can work with it. But really, when it's that strong and it's that automatic, doing therapy specifically to work with the shame and the emotions that came from that is really essential.
Wonderful. That explains shame so well, and I think everybody who just heard that recognizes the shame that we all carry individually, because it seems to be one of those kind of latent little parts of our psyche that we really want to stick our head in the sand with and don't want to admit.
Yeah, not so little either. It's actually
terrible.
I mean, there's a famous,
I hate feeling shame.
Yeah, there's a famous poll that asks what people are most afraid of, and dying, death came in like third or fourth. What came first was speaking in public.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, even more so would be speaking in public naked, just the sense of complete exposure.
Right.
And the adjective mortifying is completely appropriate here. There's that sense of just wanting to disappear, and where's a hole I can hide in? Shame is that unpleasant of a feeling. It's not fear. It's not anger. It's a unique emotion unto itself, but it does not feel good for good reason, because it feels so bad.
Right.
We have to do something with it immediately. Unfortunately, many of us will turn, get aggressive with the others who have dared to put us in this position, or we'll get very aggressive with ourselves, or withdraw, we'll run away from it.
But that's why it's so important in a relationship for the people to know their own relationship to shame, because, my gosh, here's the person that you're most vulnerable with, you're so close to, and then if they are shaming you by just saying something like, I'm so disappointed in you,
yeah,
or whatever,
right,
it is, and that's the most horrifying feeling. Well, okay, now I'm feeling shame about this person who sees me so well must see me as defective, and that can really hurt the relationship.
You know what else really helps here, and we haven't mentioned it yet, is having a healthy spiritual life.
Yes.
Which includes some sort of awareness practice. I don't mean necessarily a mantra or something that can cause dissociation or separation from embodied life, but a practice where you just sit there and you open to what's arising and you keep it in perspective so you can see the triggering, you can sense the feelings emerging, and you're not trying to get away from them,
mm-hmm,
which I would call spiritual bypassing. You're staying with them. You're feeling the anger, the sadness, the grief, the joy, whatever it is, you're staying with it. And when you have that developed in yourself enough that when you're caught in a reactive bout with a partner, which is inevitable for everyone at certain times, you have more of a capacity to see what's going on. You may still act it out, but you know better internally. You know you're not doing your best because you can see what's going on. And spiritual practice really helps with that. Without that, the psychological work can sometimes just feel like it's emotional work. It's just too much. But with the spiritual perspective, we can make our container for this whole thing bigger.
Right.
So in our relationship, for example, our spirituality is completely wedded to our psychological and emotional dimensions. It's like one thing, one wholeness co-arising.
And wouldn't that meld your intuitive and your analytical aspects of who you are by having that spiritual foundation and basis?
Oh, yes, What happens, the mind gets quieter, and the quieter our mind is, the more clearly we can hear our intuition. And the way we work, for example, in sessions and groups, is no plan, no preset methodology. So if I'm doing a group, we're doing a group, I have no sense of what I'm going to do next a lot of the time, but there's always an intuitive sense that's triggered by whoever we're with, their energy and intentions, their emotional expression touches me in a way where my intuition is so loud and clear I have to follow it. And this is actually the hardest thing we have to do when we train people to be psychotherapists or counselors, is to hear their intuition and trust it, mm-hmm. go with it.
Right.
And the more deeply you meditate, the more spaciousness you have between your thoughts, the more easily you can hear the voice of your intuition.
Yes.
And because we both trust each other's ability to do that, and because of our connection, then we trust the other person's intuition implicitly, so that that's what creates the flow when we're working with people, because one of us will have a hit. It'll suddenly, and we'll both just run with it.
Right. It's like a validation. It creates that bridge. That's I bet your workshops, your group work is just phenomenal.
It's pretty dynamic.
I bet you guys are just an incredible team together. I can just imagine, visualize that.
You know what's fascinating too is that we felt very, very close early on, and we keep getting closer. It's astonishing. We're realizing now, it's not like there's a certain place we reach and that's it. It's bottomless. It's edgeless. The love gets deeper and deeper. The integrity gets deeper. Just everything deepens. And then we have the privilege of we get to sit together side by side and do our work with individuals, couples, and the groups without any plan. And just sit there, and it's just we're present with them. The intuition flows. And it almost always goes well. And in our groups, there's a remarkable sense of intimacy and safety and sanctuary that's generated often in the first hour or two of a week-long group. Once someone's done some deep work, the whole group's involved because we involve everyone in the work, and we do small groups so everyone gets lots of attention, small number of participants. There's this sense of sanctuary. It's a bit like our relationship. There's a sanctuary. There's a lot of deep, painful work that happens, but there's almost always breakthroughs that are very liberating and inspiring, that are based on not getting away from the painful stuff, but by going into it and through it, which is basically one of our core teachings, is to turn toward what's painful or difficult or shadowy and skillfully go toward it with our attention and awareness until we emerge from having gone through it.
Wow.
And that's second nature to us, but a lot of people haven't considered working themselves that way. So when they come across, it's like, oh my God, this feels so natural.
Right. One of Robert's books, the title, Meeting the Dragon, you know, ending
ending our suffering by entering our pain.
By entering our pain. So that's the whole thing about turning towards our pain, turning towards our suffering. And if you're in a couple that where even just one wants to distract themselves from their pain, from their past pain, in whatever mode that can be through eating, it can be through spacing out, it can be through shopping, it can be through sex. There's so many different ways we distract ourselves from our pain, but when a couple is willing to both do that individually and to do that together, then that allows such ground and such safety that you can go deeper, and that's why we call it awakened monogamy. And you can imagine what it takes to put into the relationship with one person to do that. So it's the safety just keeps deepening when you're not leaking that energy.
What a inspiring thought, comment, and belief that you can actually be more in love the longer you're together, and that relationships don't hit this peak and then, oh, well, that's as good as it's going to get.
We know what I would say to that. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm interrupting here. Yeah, the aphrodisiac in this for us is our connection. It's not based on something separate from us. So our energy together is very strong. But the key element is the connection. So we often say to couples that want to take the relationship from good to better to incredible, make the connection priority.
Yes.
And that will create more polarity between the couple. It just opens the doors wide. Because then you don't feel like you've reached a certain plateau. Now you just kind of drift into stagnation as you get older. So that you're not really living. You're just surviving. You're getting by. And you're not prepared at all for the magnificence of that you could be. You're not prepared for your death ours is the opposite. I'm 65 almost. Diane's going to be 61 soon. But we feel ageless a lot of the time.
And right.
And we also enjoy, this is my favorite decade. I mean, I can't work out the same way. There's certain limitations I have because I'm getting older. But there's
a sense cool
of being really alive and vital. And people often say, Robert, when are you going to retire? I say,
I don't think,
as long as I got a few teeth and I can sit in a chair, I'll keep working, you know?
We often laugh about that picture of what we'll be doing 20 years from now.
Well, you know,
but
I do want to say, go ahead, Diane.
Say, when he said, when we tell couples that to make the connection priority, that doesn't just mean spending time doing special dates and, you know, making sure they have enough times during the week to make love. It's way more than that. It's about to make the connection deeper. That means both people have to delve deep within themselves to know themselves, their conditioning, their defaults, and to be vulnerable and transparent and to share that with the other person. So if someone's getting numb and they find themselves distancing, instead of just shutting down, they say, I notice I'm feeling numb, or my heart feels closed, or I feel really shut down. That
right.
immediately creates the connection by doing that.
Right.
So it's much more than just lightweight stuff. It's being willing to go into the nitty gritty with each other, really.
Right, and also being very conscious of where you are in the moment, because oftentimes there may be a partner having a rough day and they come home and they're just kind of in their own little, you know, cocoon, kind of mulling through the day and processing it, and the partner thinks something's wrong with us. You know,
so to be able
to verbalize, hey, you know, it's not you, it's the rough day I had, it has nothing to do with us, it can be a very powerful, easy, simple tool and statement to use, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other partner, if they're one who's shutting down is not tuned into it, the other one can say, I notice that you're very quiet. Is it something that you're upset with me, or is there something else going on? How are you, what are you feeling is a really important thing, and that leads to also emotional literacy is very important for each person to learn about their emotions so that they can tell the other one how they're feeling.
Yes,
Robert,
thank you for bringing that in. I was going to ask that question about emotional literacy. Yes.
Yes.
Go ahead.
In fact, Robert just finished a book for Sounds True that's called Emotional Intimacy, and he covers the whole realm. I think he writes about 18 different emotions, but it's so important for people, especially you can't just, if someone says, how are you feeling, what are you feeling, and they say, I don't know, it's generally not true. At least they're feeling numb. At least there's
right.
something. And if we can't express that, how deep can we go?
See, we never had
yeah.
an emotional literacy 101 in our educational
right.
programs, but emotional literacy is crucial. Now, most women have more of that available to them than men, but men can learn it just as deeply as women can, and it means basically knowing what you're feeling when you're feeling it, being able to express emotions cleanly, knowing our history with it, and knowing where we're coming from when we say something to another person in relationship, mm-hmm. not just saying it as though this is just me speaking, what's wrong with you,
right.
it's more like, where am I coming from, what's my intention, is my intention, it's so crucial to have enough capacity for self-reflection to know where are we coming from when we speak and when we share. And if we're coming
yes.
from an earlier wounded place in us, we need to acknowledge that, however embarrassing it may be to our ego.
Yes, and the compassion and sensitivity with our words and the diplomacy to use words that don't hurt but heal. I think that
mm-hmm.
is, you know, so important. And, you know, there's so much emphasis upon my truth and speaking my truth and all of this that there's kind of a, you know, a little bit of a detour there when people speak their
yep.
truth. They're not always considering the other person's reaction or reception to what's being
exactly.
said. So,
here's,
you know,
here's
that
an extreme
compassion.
Of it. Yeah, yeah, here's an extreme of it. I just thought of it. Many years ago, I did a large group. I had a number of people assisting me. At one point, I heard someone scream. It was a woman had slapped one of the men who was assisting me hard across the face.
No.
I walked over to her. I said, what happened? She said, well, Robert, you said we need to express our emotions. There's an extreme of, you know, okay.
Not that way.
Not that way, yeah.
And here's another thing, too. Sometimes people say things that appear to be that they're honest, that they're expressing their truth, they're expressing their honesty to their partner, when actually we will look and say, okay, what was the motivation for expressing that? Because sometimes it's just in the guise of being honest, it's something quite hurtful.
Cruel.
Yes, excellent point. Yes, excellent point. That's very true. And there's so much emphasis upon my truth and my right and all of this that I really believe, you know, there's too much of my righteousness or my self-righteousness and not enough dropping into the heart to really having that compassion.
It's not really my truth, and people say that. They're saying it's my perception.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Or my ego, even.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a bit like also saying to someone else, if they have a hard time with what I've just said to them, if I'm being sloppy, I'll say, well, that's just your stuff. It's up to you how you respond. And then I'm not taking responsibility for how I've delivered what I said. I'm not taking responsibility for the impact I'm having on that person through how I said what I said.
Right, right.
So in a healthy relationship, both people are aware of the dynamic going back and forth. No one's existing in a vacuum.
And I do want to say, Lisa, even when a couple is in a being-centered relationship and they have matured to a certain point and they are more awakened to all these different things we've been talking about, that doesn't mean that there aren't times where they are in states of me-centered or codependent, where when they're, especially if they're tired or really stressed. I mean, I know that there will be a time where we can read it really well now, and I'll say, you know, right now we're both really exhausted, and we need to be especially mindful, or we could get into a really silly argument about something where we're just snapping at each other. We've learned to kind of even anticipate things that could trigger behavior that is not helpful or constructive at all.
That's great input, Diane. That's wonderful, because that's exactly where we get off track. And it's nice to remind all of us that there's going to be phases where we're at our highs in relationship, and there's going to be circumstances and situations that bring us down to our low, and that's our growth and challenge to evolve through.
Absolutely.
To recognize it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful. You know, this has been, I have to say, such a phenomenal show for me to do, and I thank you from the bottom of my soul that both of you were here today. Such wisdom, such genius. This is so powerful. I really hope that we can do another show sometime.
It sounds like we'll need to. There's so much more to talk about.
I think we are. I have a load of questions and pages here I didn't even address.
Yeah.
So, I will definitely be in touch. This is an absolute favorite of mine here. But we have about 4 minutes. So can we give the audience just a few off the top of your head, some basic guidelines in regard to like our evolution in regard to relationships? And you have a subject, a topic here where you offer actually guidelines for deepening relational intimacy. Can, off the top of your head, what would you say to our listeners to bring them mindful in their relationship?
One thing I would say, and this applies to relationship in the broadest, deepest sense, is turn toward your pain. You don't have to move toward it fast or get overheated by it or blown away by it, but turn toward it, noticing the tendency you might have to get away from it. Turn toward the difficult. Second thing I'd say is practice getting closer to all that you are. Start with your emotions. Get more intimate with them. Whatever that takes, start the process and be patient with it. It's a slow process, it's very growthful, and it's incredibly rewarding.
Wonderful.
I think I would add that in that process, consider doing some kind of therapy that involves the emotions and hopefully the body too, so that you can find out, be curious, find out what makes you up, and share that with your partner.
Yes, this has been, you two are such an incredible dynamic couple, and what a gift you are to all of us for relationships, not only in living your truth and you're modeling it, but to teach and to guide all of us as we we all strive to have more of an evolved and deepening in our relationships. This has been such a joy for me today, such a highlight.
Thank you so much, Lisa. This has been
thank
so much
you.
Fun.
Thank you. You too. I love you guys. I feel such a kindred soul connection with you both.
So I just want to thank you. To be continued.
Yes,
thank you. I love that.
Okay.
I love that very
okay.
much. Many
okay.
blessings.
Listeners,
please tune in to Diane and Robert Masters at www.robertmasters.com. And